Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The March jobs report was out this morning. Good news, it's a pleasure to say, unless you're still looking for work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us. And the employment news this first Friday of the month is, for a long overdue change, pretty good. The economy added 216,000 jobs in March. The unemployment rate hit a two-year low of 8.8%. And almost everywhere you looked, there was hiring. Manufacturing, healthcare, education, hotels, and restaurants. Temporary work is up, which gives at least some of the unemployed a way back into the workforce. But the better it gets for most, the worse it gets for some. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Private employers have hired more than 500,000 new workers this year, and the unemployment rate's fallen a full percent since Thanksgiving.
The better the news, the less most of the rest of us worry about the people who are without jobs.
Gary Bertlis is a labor economist at the Brookings Institution.
The layoff rate has come way down, and unfortunately that makes a lot of employed people a little less sympathetic.
Which makes Melissa Botiak's job way harder. She's campaign coordinator for an anti-poverty coalition called Half in 10. And all this good job news?
It can mask the needs of the long-term unemployed. Nearly half of the unemployed have been out of work for 6 months or longer. That's 6.1 million people. And about a third have been out of work for over a year.
And the situation's getting worse. The average job hunt now takes 39 weeks, the longest since 1948.
One of the things that we can do is to invest in job training.
That's a seriously uphill battle, though, with Republicans in Congress trying to slash this year's worker education budget. Gary Bertlis at Brookings says job training can help older and less educated workers find a place in the new economy.
But I don't think we should kid ourselves that it's going to play a big role in the next year or 2 years in getting the unemployment rate down.
That's because there are still about 5 job seekers for every available job, so even retrained workers will face plenty of competition. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Corn prices hit a 2.5-year high today. It's the highest they've been since the global food crisis back in the summer of 2008. Those rising prices are behind at least part of what's been happening in the Middle East. They're contributing to shortages in some developing countries. Back here, though, it's more of a business equation for the food industry, restaurants in particular. Chains are looking for ways to stock up on pricey ingredients without going broke. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
You have to feel a little sorry for the restaurant business. During the recession, people ate out a lot less. But now, just as customers have started coming back, the prices of many ingredients, from flour to meat, are going way up. David Donnan follows the food business at A.T. Kearney, which is a consulting firm. He says those rising prices have restaurants changing the way they shop.
If you're buying hamburger, you may want to go out and buy actual extra frozen hamburger meat and put it into storage. Rather than buying it on a monthly basis, you may actually buy 3 or 4 months at a time.
So the restaurant doesn't have to worry, at least for a while, if ground beef gets more expensive. Some chains are doing the opposite. Darden Foods, the company that owns Red Lobster, is working on a system that would let it buy only what it needs when it needs it. Kind of like the sophisticated delivery networks car makers and electronics producers use. Other restaurants are teaming up and buying cooperatives. Dennis Lombardi is a restaurant consultant at a company called WD Partners. He says restaurants can't pass on the additional cost to customers for fear they'll stop eating out again.
Most restaurants will strive to create a balance and try to offset it with either new menu items that maybe uses a less expensive protein, or certainly a trend we're seeing to smaller portions, which allows for a more attractive price point.
He says Togo's, a California chain, recently introduced mini versions of some sandwiches, and Bob Evans family-style restaurants have started offering a saver size. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Even if you've never bought a cut-rate yoga class on Groupon or a half-price cashmere sweater on Gilt, you still might have heard of the phenomenon, what are called daily deal websites. The promotions might have popped up in your inbox, half price off or whatever, but only today. Best guesses are purchases made from Daily Deal websites could top $1 billion this year. So, of course, retailers of all stripes are getting in on the daily action directly, trying to cut out the middleman. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Is your inbox starting to get a little full? Cole Haan's got a deal on handbags, 25% off for 24 hours. Expedia's got a 12-hour screamin' sale on hotel rooms in Puerto Vallarta. It's as if all of retail suddenly discovered the flash sale. Kevin Sternekert is with Gartner.
Everyone seems to be attempting to jump on the crest of the wave of Groupon.
Groupon got huge offering cut-rate deals at places like restaurants and boutiques and taking a cut. Craig Elston of the marketing agency Integer Group says retailers see all those sales and figure they can cut out the middleman.
I can't believe there are many retailers out there who aren't taking notice and aren't looking at this.
There's also the image thing. Analyst Jennifer Black says some high-end brands don't want their daily deals to follow the ones from the local body shop.
I've heard from a number of retailers that, like, tried it once, and they said, you know, we feel this isn't the best thing for our brand.
But she says offering sales direct to your inbox allow retailers to preserve their brand and study the way you buy. Oh, Victoria's Secret's got a deal for me. Gotta go. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
On Wall Street this Friday, up for the day, up for the week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Time to do that thing we do on Fridays, make economic sense of the 5 days gone by. Here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond is our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore. Also, Cardiff Garcia from FT Alphaville at the Financial Times. Heidi, Cardiff, good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take that jobs report that Mitchell Hartman was talking about, and we're going to flip it on its head, Cardiff. And I want to go to the American consumer, because once people start getting jobs, they're going to start spending, we hope, and bring this economy out of it. But we had some data the past, like, week or so, which is a little sketchy on this. Help me out.
It is sketchy, and I'm having a lot of trouble discerning exactly what the trends are in spending right now. So at the end of last year, consumption was a big part of what was driving the accelerating recovery.
Consumption, people spending, right?
That's right. It's just a fancy economist-y word for people spending.
Yeah, don't
right?
do that anymore.
Okay. And economists sort of had an idea that that would continue at a certain pace. And it turns out that in the first couple of months of the year, people were increasing their spending at a slower rate than people expected. On the other hand, you had such massive events taking place. You had, you know, the rise in these prices. You had Japan. You had turmoil in the Middle East. And it's actually surprising that things weren't worse. So there's still a possibility that if jobs keep improving the way they are, then consumption might actually pick up again, and there's still space in people's budgets for them to both absorb higher prices and keep spending.
Heidi, give me your sense. Are we going to, in the face of Japan and the Middle East and gas at $4.50 a gallon, I mean, does that point to consumers saying, heck yeah, let's buy the new whatever?
Well, it's really hard to tell what the consumer's thinking, actually, because we have several different kinds of consumers in the United States. And the people who aren't educated aren't doing very well. And the people who are and who have some money are acting in their own interest. They're not necessarily acting in the same patterns that we've been used to in the past. So I don't think that we can pull out any single trend across the country, but people just are having the lives that they're having right now. And we're going to have to wait for a lot of stuff to shake out before we can really see where we're going.
Cardiff, let me ask you this. Let me do something that interviewers are never supposed to do, right, which is question the premise of an earlier question. What if we're not going to have a consumption-led recovery? What if consumers aren't going to be able to pick up this economy and run with it by spending? Where else is the drive going to come from?
Great question. I'm glad you decided to break the rules. Look, the hope is that businesses will continue investing. Now, businesses still have huge wads of cash on their balance sheets. It's just that so far they haven't been spending it on capital or on hiring, on plants and equipment and things like that, to the extent that we wish they would. They are starting to increase it a little bit, but the hope is that at some point if they become a little more optimistic about the economy generally, that they'll increase the pace of that. The other one is exports. That's where the other part of the comeback would have to take place. But that's also going to require a pretty big rebalancing, not just of the U.S. economy, but of the global economy. And that's a more complicated question.
Well, Heidi, pick it up from there and talk about the global economy and our place in it as a consuming, that is, consumer spending society.
Yeah, well, you've actually hit on a really important point, which is, isn't it kind of sick to judge ourselves on how much we spend as opposed to how much we save? That makes us pretty unique in the world. In Germany, they have a lot of savings. Japan is well known for its savings. And not incidentally, those are economies that are much more productive in many ways. So we do have to question whether we're kind of judging ourselves the right way. But at the same time, America is still, for whatever reason, very strong globally. And there are a lot of countries, especially in Europe and even in Asia, where growth has been slowing or there have even been economic bailouts and more trouble. So, you know, we shouldn't take the hand-wringing too far. We're doing pretty well, but certainly we could be doing better. And a lot of that comes from some soul-searching about how we're using our money, and we still haven't figured that out.
Heidi Moore, she runs our bureau in New York. Cardiff Garcia writes for the FT Alphaville blog at the Financial Times. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
When you walk into a grocery store, there are ads everywhere. There are ads on milk cartons, there are ads on the floor, there are ads on the very shopping carts that we're pushing around. Sometimes it seems like advertising is consuming us. But now, we're consuming advertising. Science lets us change the color and sometimes even the shapes of the foods that we grow. And Madison Avenue has the recipe, as Sally Herships reports.
The Averill family is having hamburgers for dinner. Sounds typical, but the Averills, Jenny, Drew, and their 6-year-old son, Will, are a test household in Brooklyn. That means they try out new products for advertisers.
William, have you ever heard of genetic engineering?
Genetic what?
Genetic engineering lets scientists modify the characteristics of crops, like corn, to make them, say, more pest-resistant. But the Averill's dinner was genetically engineered by advertisers.
William, do you want to say hi to Mr. Pickle?
Yes.
Check this out. As Will's burger cooks, a picture of a pickle appears on the burger. It gets darker the longer it stays over the flame. When the meat reaches 160 degrees Fahrenheit, Mr. Pickle looks like he's waving.
Is Mr. Pickle waving at me? Hi, Mr. Pickle, hi!
A real pickle on Will's burger, you can understand. But an ad for pickles? I asked Jason Torchinsky, what's going on?
Scientists, they're able now to alter the appearance of food in ways that they never have before. For advertisers, it's a whole new medium.
Jason Torchinsky has written the definitive book on advertising.
This new technology, synthetic biology, means we can now engineer naturally occurring bacteria and have them moved or grouped together in patterns, and they can then secrete colors visible to the naked eye.
Like the pickle ad on the burger. But how about ads in your ice cream? Earlier this year, Cornell's computational synthesis lab came out with a 3D food printer. It squeezes mushy foods like vanilla caramel fudge through a syringe to create images in food.
So this ice cream maker created a line of cones with coupons inside the ice cream. You take a bite of your ice cream and there's a secret code. It's like something out of Willy Wonka.
Lee Silver is a market researcher at Nigel Gibbons. He specializes in consumers and food. What are the coupons for?
More ice cream, of course.
So, will consumers eat food with the new ads? To find out, I headed to my local grocery store. Would you buy this steak?
I'm sorry, but 20% off isn't worth having to see ads at dinner.
It's in the steak. It's like branded into the steak. That's crazy. Are you freaking kidding me?
But back in Brooklyn, the Averill family is happy to serve up dinner with ads. They like getting a discount on dinner. And Will Averill likes playing with his food, exactly what advertisers hoped for. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Crazy story, huh? What's the date today? We'll be right back. Coming up, starting over in your 50s isn't easy, you know, unless you choose carefully.
Actually, the medical profession is one of the few fields that actually prefers the older person.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street kept a strong week today with more gains. The Dow Industrials added 56 points, about a half percent, ended at 12,376. The Nasdaq picked up 8 points, nearly a third of 1%, closed at 2789. The S&P 500 tacked on 6 points, about a half percent, wrapped up at 1332. For the week, the Dow beefed up almost 1.33%. The Nasdaq bounced nearly 1.75% higher. The S&P 500 rose 1.4% since Friday. No fooling, since 1950, April is historically the best month for the Dow Industrials. The Stock Traders Almanac says the Dow has gained, on average, 2% during the month of April. Shares of Chevron spurted higher more than 0.75% today. ExxonMobil stock advanced 0.75%. ConocoPhillips, on the other hand, slipped almost 0.25%. Bond prices rose. That lowered the yield on the 10-year T-note to 3.45%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The annual World Healthcare Congress gets underway in Washington. The results of the 21st Annual National Airline Quality Rating, or AQR, are announced at the National Press Club. The study covers 16 airlines from AirTran to U.S. Airways. And it's the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. King was shot at Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. All right, so to recap, even after today's unemployment report, we're still down about 7 million jobs from the start of the recession. On the other side of the economic balance sheet, there's a federal budget deficit that runs more than $1 trillion this year alone. Total federal debt runs 14 times that. Which brings us to Christina Romer. She chaired the Council of Economic Advisors for the first 2 years of the Obama administration. Now she's back teaching economics at UC Berkeley, but she has been very public lately about saying the administration has to do more to create jobs and take care of the long-term budget deficit. So when we spoke, I asked her about that, whether government stimulus and cutting down debt at the same time doesn't seem a little inconsistent.
The way that you square the circle is to say they all need to be part of a comprehensive package. And that's not at all a crazy thing. If you look at one of the alternative deficit commissions, the one chaired by former Senator Domenici and former CBO Director Alice Rivlin, they said, let's start with a big payroll tax cut in 2011. That's what you do for jobs. Then as we start to recover, what's the range of serious things that you do to get our long-run deficit under control? That's a sensible, comprehensive package that deals with both problems, because the longer unemployment stays high, the more likely it is to stay permanently higher. And that would be not just a disaster for people, but for the budget deficit as well.
Do you still talk to people on the political side of things in Washington, not just your economic colleagues, but people on the Hill?
I certainly do love to keep up with the team in the White House, but no, I'm not up talking to Congress and things the way I used to.
Well, the reason I ask is because, as you know, we're having some disagreement in Washington about how to handle the deficit and what to do about it. And I'm wondering what your sense is of any realistic possibility that any of these ideas that you have mentioned or others on deficit commissions have mentioned might actually come to fruition.
You know, the one thing I will say is we, you know, saw 64 senators say we need to do something about the long-run deficit. That's certainly showing you that there are a lot of political players that feel, as I do, that this is a really important issue and something that we need to be dealing with. I understand this will be incredibly hard. A lot of things are incredibly hard, but you have to do them.
You know, I do seem to recall when you were running the Council of Economic Advisors that when the jobs numbers would come out as the unemployment rate inched above 9% and then hit 10%, you would come out and do morning talk shows on the lawn of the White House there. And the gist of your comments would be, listen, we're really trying, but it's hard to get jobs done.
No.
And taken care of. So what could you have done? I mean, had you something to do over, what would you do over?
you know, we were always talking about things that we would do. And that's part of why, you know, we certainly took aggressive action early on with the Recovery Act and the financial rescue. It's why we took a number of smaller measures as we went on, everything from a small business jobs bill to extending unemployment insurance. I think there was potentially a chance to be more aggressive maybe in the fall or winter, you know,
of 2009.
Yeah. I think that's where maybe lots of policymakers took their eye a little bit off the jobs ball. You know, we saw the feds talk about exit rather than what more can we do. And I think Congress certainly was not interested in doing much more on jobs. And I think all of us could have pushed harder and should have pushed harder.
What needs to happen right now, though? I mean, your name is on two very high-profile letters out there calling for more to be done on jobs and more to be done on the deficit. What has to be done? What do you want to see happen?
Right now, we're on this terrible trajectory of everybody's talking about the 2011 budget and talking about cutting spending right now. And that's exactly the wrong policy. It's wrong for jobs, and it doesn't do anything about the long-run budget deficit. What we need is a much more sensible whole package that says do some more for jobs now, but pass right now so everyone knows what's in place, how we get the deficit down over time. Believe me, I certainly know it's hard. And that, again, that doesn't mean that it isn't worth thinking very hard about what are the things that would have the highest bang for the buck. I think that's part of why I'm very taken with a payroll tax cut for employers, because that both has an aggregate demand component. It just cuts taxes, but it also has an incentive component. It lowers the cost of hiring a worker, and hiring is exactly what we need them to do.
Christina Romer is a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Until a year or so ago, she was the chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House. Dr. Romer, thanks very much for your time.
Sure, thank you.
Back in the early 1990s, a freelance producer named Deb Monroe started filing stories for us, not long after she'd left a job in television news to stay home with her two young kids. Those kids are practically grown now, so a couple of years ago, Deb decided to go back to work. Like the rest of the news business, though, local television has changed quite a bit in the past 20 years, so much so that Deb decided to switch careers to one of the brighter spots in the economy, healthcare. But now that she's finished her 2 years of studying to be a medical assistant, she's discovered the road to a job in healthcare is jam-packed.
When I first started at Kenyatta College in Silicon Valley, I thought I had an edge. After all, I'd been a news producer, a legal secretary, even a new media startup executive. And then I started talking with my classmates. In crowded classes like medical insurance, billing, and transcription, I find myself surrounded by former engineers, airline employees, even former recruiters. Turns out, lots of other people had the same idea of switching to healthcare.
I started researching fields that were hiring, that were growing, and healthcare was one of the biggest.
Ann Nolan is a small business owner who wants to work an extra decade before retiring. I met her my first day in the medical assisting program, and when I see her again, I learn she's got a clever new plan to increase her marketability.
We have an added strategy, which is to take phlebotomy as well, you know, the drawing of blood, so that our options for employment are that much greater.
That's enough to make my blood pressure shoot up. Which is funny, because when I run into Anne, she's practicing taking blood pressure readings on fellow students.
I got 118 over 82. What do you know?
Instead of going the clinical route, like Anne, I've chosen the administrative side of healthcare, specifically medical coding, a system used to bill insurance companies. I run my plan by instructor Kate Charlton, who's been a nurse for 30 years. Charlton says going into coding is a good idea. For one simple reason.
Because that's where the money is.
If you don't use the right codes, the doctor or hospital won't get paid enough to cover services.
Every doctor, every clinic, every hospital knows that a good coder means increased revenue for their office.
Good news, now that I'm done and ready to look for work, but I still need to find an entry-level job in a new field at my age.
Actually, the medical profession is one of the few fields that actually prefers the older person.
says instructor Victoria Clinton, although she's quick to remind me that is, in this tight job market, if you're the creme de la creme of older workers.
Anytime you have more people entering a field, then they just simply up their standards of what they want.
So do I have what it takes? Well, I applied for a job as an admin assistant in a small medical office and got a nice rejection letter. More than 75 people had responded to the doctor's ad in the first 48 hours. Oh well, not surprising considering the economy, but I can't help but feel deflated. After spending 2 years retraining for a shiny new career in healthcare, the competition is a lot tougher than I'd imagined. In Redwood City, this is Deb Monroe for Marketplace.
Deb's next challenge, advice from her daughter on snapping that perfect picture for her online resume.
You can do black and white or sepia tone. It kind of erases all the imperfections on your face.
That story is coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, oil closed at almost $108 a barrel in New York this afternoon. That's actually a good thing because it implies traders think the economy and thus demand for oil is coming back stronger. But that's not really what I wanted to talk about. The anticipated future price of crude is a bit more relevant than today's close. So this item from the Institute of International Finance, that's a global banking group, deserves a mention. They figure the Saudi Arabian government, the world's biggest supplier of crude, needs oil to average $88. Average price, $88 a barrel this year, just to break even. That is avoid government deficits. That's up from a $68 break-even point last year. How come, you ask? All that spending the Saudi government's doing to keep its citizens happy and not in the streets. We are happy it's Friday. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is JJ Yor. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.